in conflict with a majority of the House of Representatives. They want more information about the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Why does the president struggle to shake it off? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The direct economic pain of a government shutdown is ending. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Federal workers resume getting paid and food assistance flows. But what about the indirect damage to the broader economy? We have an assessment. Also, Ken Burns says the American Revolution is the most significant event in human history since the birth of Christ. It's Friday, November 14th. This day in 1960, federal marshals escorted 6-year-old Ruby Bridges past angry white crowds. And with that act, she desegregated a New Orleans elementary. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Trump administration is planning a special immigration enforcement operation in Charlotte, North Carolina. Nick Della Canal of member station WFAE reports Border Patrol agents could arrive there as soon as this weekend.
The Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office says Border Patrol agents will arrive in Charlotte in the coming days. But details are still vague, including how many federal agents and for how long. Charlotte City Councilman-elect J.D. Mazuera Arias, an immigrant from Colombia who did not always have legal status himself, says the government should be more transparent.
If there is an operation or presence in Charlotte, the public has the right to know what's happening and why it's happening.
Latino advocacy groups say the announcement has already sparked fear, with families staying home and immigration help hotlines lighting up. For NPR News, I'm Nick Della Canal in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Federal employees are getting back to work now that the government shutdown has ended. In Jackson, Mississippi, IRS agent William Harris says it's been a rough year for him. He was laid off in February during agency cuts, rehired in September, then sidelined again during the shutdown.
A lot of people's lives are impacted by the decisions or lack of decisions sometimes. So stressful, but also theatrical.
Federal agencies are scrambling to restart everything from routine paperwork to clearing airport backups, delays that forced airlines to cancel thousands of flights this month. The FAA says airports should return to normal operations once flight restrictions tied to safety staffing are lifted. United and Delta say Thanksgiving travel should be fine after both airlines reported a slowdown in ticket sales during the shutdown. Russia carried out an attack on the Ukrainian capital today, launching hundreds of missiles and drones, killing at least 4 people and injuring more than 24. NPR's Joanna Kikissis reports Russia is stepping up attacks as winter approaches in an attempt to wipe out Ukraine's heating and power sources.
Ukrainian authorities say more than 400 drones were used in the assault. Ukraine's air defense tried to shoot them down. Residents awoke to the sound of machine gunfire and blasts. The head of Kyiv's military administration said Russia had struck residential buildings in nearly every neighborhood. Rescue workers are looking for survivors in the rubble. Kyiv's mayor, Vitaly Klitschko, says the city's heating infrastructure was also struck and to expect outages. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
This is NPR News in Washington. The Justice Department is suing California's Secretary of State and Governor Gavin Newsom over the state's new voter-approved redistricting plan. Federal officials say the map creates racially gerrymandered congressional districts. Newsom says the goal is to create more Democratic-leaning seats in response to a similar plan in Texas that recently added several likely Republican seats. A number of states are weighing mid-decade redistricting ahead of next year's midterm elections. Puerto Rican superstar Bad Bunny took home the biggest award at the Latin Grammys, Album of the Year. It was his first win in one of the main categories, as NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento reports.
Bad Bunny won 5 awards during the 26th annual Latin Grammys in Las Vegas. But he seemed most moved by Album of the Year for Debí Tirar Más Fotos, an homage to his home island.
Este premio se lo quiero dedicar.
He dedicated the award to all the young people of Latin America and Puerto Rico in particular. The other big awards of the night went to familiar faces. Colombian singer Karol G won Song of the Year for her merengue hit Si Antes Te Hubiera Conocido alongside fellow songwriters Edgar Barrera and Andrés Correa Ríos. Spanish singer Alejandro Sanz won Record of the Year for his song Palmeras en el Jardín. And Best New Artist went to Mexican pop star Paloma Murphy. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics with Nuremberg, a new thriller starring Russell Crowe, Rami Malek, and Michael Shannon about the historic post-World War II trial of Nazi official Hermann Göring, now playing in theaters.
Well, I've got two brothers and they're in the Marines.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled in Lead, urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days, it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it, because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
Climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his highway cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Good morning. President Trump is finishing this week in conflict with a majority of the House of Representatives.
That conflict emerged just as the House returned to work and reopened the government. Some Republicans joined Democrats to revive discussions of Jeffrey Epstein. As we have reported, a House committee released 23,000 documents about the convicted sex offender. The more than 1,000 mentions of Trump in those documents include an email saying Trump spent hours at Epstein's house with a victim, and another in which Epstein says Trump, quote, knew about the girls.
To discuss the White House's response, we have NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivram with us. Good morning.
Hey, Leila.
Hey, so the release of these documents has been a key demand of the president's supporters. What's the reaction been to this latest release of files?
Well, Republican political strategist Alex Conan said the news around these documents isn't necessarily changing people's minds in the next election, say, but it doesn't exactly add up to a good week for Trump.
And I don't know that it's damaging, but it's very distracting. You know, with the government reopening, Trump arguably had a great week, but instead, everyone's talking about this Epstein story that just won't go away.
The White House says these documents don't prove anything. They say that Trump did nothing wrong. And the White House and the president are trying to frame the release of these documents as a distraction. They're saying that Democrats who released some of these files ahead of the House Oversight Committee's release are trying to take attention away from the government shutdown ending. Trump on Truth Social called it the Jeffrey Epstein hoax and said Democrats are trying to use it to, quote, deflect from their massive failures.
Right, but it was also Republicans who wanted these released, some Republicans. Well, the other thing that happened this week is the House reached enough signatures for a discharge petition to force the release of more documents from the Department of Justice. Does the White House feel any added pressure from this petition?
Right. So this petition that we're talking about requires 218 votes. That's, of course, a majority of the House members. And what it does is force a vote on any issue, even if House leadership doesn't want it. And one of the Republicans that's working with Democrats on this is Colorado Representative Lauren Boebert. She's been an ally of Trump's, but she's signed signed on to this petition, and she was called into the White House for a meeting in the Situation Room where the Epstein files and this petition were discussed. It was kind of seen as this potential pressure campaign from the White House. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt was asked about this meeting in the briefing earlier this week, and she said that the White House was just being transparent with members of Congress. And Boebert herself spoke to Colorado Public Radio about it.
There was no pressure, and I mean, everybody was great and worked just well with me.
So it's not fully clear what happened inside the Situation Room, but the thing with this petition to keep in mind is that it probably isn't going to go anywhere after this House vote. The Senate is controlled by Republicans. They're probably not going to take up this vote. And even if they did and it passed, Trump himself is the one who'd have to sign it into law, which is even less likely to happen.
Okay, so if this petition is likely to die, is the White House hoping then this just all goes away after that?
Yeah, you know, I talked to Conan about that too, and he says the White House should have handled this Epstein story very differently by putting out all the information that they have. Now, the White House says that they've been transparent, but at the same time, Trump uncharacteristically doesn't seem to want to answer questions about it. Conant says that Trump's strategy typically has been deflect, deflect, attack, attack, and then try to change the story. But because of the slow drip of this Epstein story, because this was a campaign promise that Trump made to release these documents, he just can't shake this story.
I'm PR's Deepa Shivaram. Thank you, Deepa.
Thanks.
Okay, what have we really learned from this week of revelations? We have an assessment from Ryan Goodman, who has followed the story for years. He's a professor of law at New York University and co-editor-in-chief of the online forum Just Security. Mr. Goodman, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, what stands out for you here, really?
What stands out for me is Epstein speaking with confidants in private emails about Donald Trump at the time, and that he would in fact say things that indicate the president knew very well what was happening in Epstein's home and with some of the trafficked victims, having spent hours with one of the trafficked victims in Epstein's home, which Epstein actually describes that in relationship to law enforcement, which I thought was also very significant. So that's just about knowledge, but that's significant in terms of what we think about the morality of somebody knowing what's happening with the sexual abuse and potentially the trafficking. And then there's other emails that indicate that it might be worse than that, especially Epstein's communications with the author Michael Wolff, where the two of them seem to be plotting that Epstein has information that would be very derogatory about Trump and his relationship to Epstein. At one point, Wolff says to Epstein, quote, "I think you should let him hang himself," mm-hmm. end quote. And I thought that was very significant.
There is a reference to Trump spending hours in a house with one of Epstein's victims. As I understand it, the victim is not named, but then the White House spokesperson, Caroline Levitt, named her and said that was Virginia Giuffre, who before her death made statements effectively exonerating Trump. What do you make of that?
So I do believe that it is her because the Democrats, when they released the email, they redacted her name as a victim. And then very troubling to me is that the Republican-led committee, when they released the email, they did not redact her name. So we know it's her. And it is true that in her deposition, she does say that the president did not behave badly towards her. She at one point had maybe told a reporter that he had flirted with her. But in the deposition says he did not. That is false, that he did nothing wrong with her. So I think that the Epstein email, there's a strange discrepancy there. But maybe he means that Donald Trump knew because he was in the home with the person who could tell him things about what was going on. Or maybe Epstein, because this is an email between him and Ghislaine Maxwell, gets the wrong, unfortunately, victim in naming her. But there is something odd about that. And I'll mention one other oddity. Also, Giuffre, in her deposition, says that she doesn't remember ever seeing Donald Trump at Epstein's home. So there are questions that are raised by these emails as much as there are questions that might be answered.
You mentioned Michael Wolff. He's a prominent writer. He's had best-selling books. He's written about Trump for a long time. Clearly was covering Epstein for a long time. Does it strike you as strange or over a line that he appears to be giving Epstein public relations advice in private?
100%. He, to my mind, oversteps the line of journalism and author and seems to be complicit with Epstein in trying to manage Epstein's public relations. And as you just described it, even to the point that I've wondered, you know, could he himself be a target of law enforcement? Because if law enforcement really wanted to find out Are there other co-conspirators? Who was involved? Michael Wolff has said that he has hours of tapes with Epstein, and now we understand better their relationship. You would think that law enforcement would at least ask him for that.
There are all these other names, of course, in these files, including Democrats, we should note. Bill Clinton is mentioned. His relationship with Epstein was known. I guess there's an email saying that he never went to Epstein's private island. Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, is mentioned. His friendship with Epstein was known, but we get more details there. What do you feel you learned from the additional characters in this drama?
So I think there's a very disturbing information about them, including Mr. Summers, because he's also not just discussing finance with Epstein. He's discussing women in, I would consider, derogatory ways. And when those people, including Democrats, are communicating with Epstein in these friendly ways or even supporting Epstein in his quote-unquote lifestyle, they're doing it also in the year 2019. I mean, everybody should have known better after Epstein had to plead guilty in Florida, but in 2019, it's after the blockbuster series of revelations by the Miami Herald that showed what Epstein was up to that led to the resignation of a secretary, Acosta, in the first Trump administration, that led to the indictment in the SDNY. So the fact that you have these emails with people palling around with Epstein, who at that point is essentially a known sexual abuser, I think is deeply disturbing.
Ryan Goodman of NYU, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, apologized to President Trump for a documentary about the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot. What it doesn't want to do is pay him. Villa Marx reports.
The London station of the British Broadcasting Company calling.
For more than a century, the BBC has been the voice of Britain, broadcasting comedies and crisis.
We are at war.
Monarch speeches and musical performances. The public funds it through a TV license fee, and written in its royal charter, its mission is to inform, educate, and entertain. But there's little to laugh about as this UK institution prepares for a potential lawsuit from a US president. Donald Trump's billion-dollar legal threat accuses the BBC of defamation.
We're going to walk down to the Capitol.
For juxtaposing in a documentary two separate parts of a speech Trump made on January the 6th. The broadcasters acknowledged the editing was misleading. Trump's ultimatum, though, touched a national nerve for some, including a BBC radio guest called Simon, who gave just his first name.
If we have to pay a penny to Trump, then I'm sorry, I'm not going to pay my TV license. The world just seems to be frightened of him. I think the BBC needs to stand up to him.
Media commentators like Jane Martinson, a journalism professor at London City University, says this case is not just about impartial reporting, but also national pride.
The idea that an American president would sue the British broadcaster, paid for by British taxpayers, is pretty astonishing.
For despite its global reach, the BBC remains deeply British and loved, says Stuart Purvis, the former CEO of the BBC's biggest rival.
It's almost like combining one or two or even three of the American networks. Everybody loves the BBC in some way, but everyone has something to complain about the BBC.
Government Minister Lisa Nandy told Parliament this week it plays a crucial role in the country's cultural and democratic life.
At a time when the lines are being dangerously blurred between fact and opinion, news and polemic, the BBC stands apart.
Now, with Trump's lawsuit perhaps more likely, Britons are already asking, will the national broadcaster use their money to pay for a legal fight against a foreign leader? For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx in London.
This is NPR News.
It's 6:19. Coming up in an hour, you'll hear local news with the Up North Report. We'll talk with Marshall Helmberger from the Timberjay newspaper, serving Cook, Tower, and Ely areas of northeastern Minnesota. We've got the Up North Report coming up for you at 7:01 or at 8:30 this morning, right after the sports page. Mostly sunny skies today with highs 54 to 60 with south winds 10 to 20, evening lows in the mid-30s to low 40s, and mostly sunny tomorrow, Saturday, highs 40 to 46 degrees. This week, we're asking about shop class and home ec. What do you remember? What are the projects you worked on? Maybe you still have them. We heard yesterday from DJ Dang about the napkin holder his mother kept around for a long time. I, too, made a napkin holder in metal class that could see big hunks of soldering on there because I was not great at it. Nancy from Twig wrote in to us when I was in seventh grade, I think in 1970, home ec was all girls and we made half slips. So times have changed a little bit. Carolyn King says she learned to sew on a Singer treadle sewing machine in ninth grade home ec at Valley Junior High in Grand Forks. I'll take a treadle over any electric any day. It was fun pumping away though. Text us your stories. That's what we do. We share a story each week. Helps us all feel a little more connected. 218-326-1234.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From Odoo, maker of business management software, with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Filmmaker Ken Burns has examined some of the most defining moments of American history, the Civil War, America's response to the Holocaust, and the evolution of jazz music. Burns spent 10 years making his latest documentary series on the American Revolution.
Everything that is right or natural pleads for separation. We have it in our power to begin the world over again. A situation similar to the present hath not happened since the days of Noah until now. The birthday of a new world is at hand.
Ken Burns spoke with our co-host, Michelle Martin.
You've said repeatedly that the American Revolution is, quote, the most significant event in human history since the birth of Christ. Tell me more.
I wanted to sort of wake people up to this idea of how significant it was that for most of human history, most people had been subjects under authoritarian rule. And that what happened in the eastern seaboard of North America created citizens, this new thing with responsibilities. And it was so interesting that the way that so many of the so-called founding fathers thought about us, about you and me, they kept talking about unborn millions that would be influenced by this, that you began to realize there was a way to arrest people's attention in our distracted moment right now. There was a kind of energy and frisson as we were developing the film, and you began to realize this is a really big deal.
You know, I'm not a scholar in this area by any means, but I do live in the Washington, D.C. area, and there are so many important, you know, historical sites within easy reach. Your series still shocked me in many ways. And one of the things that shocked me was just how vicious the fighting was. And I don't know why that didn't occur to me.
Muskets are mostly inaccurate beyond 80 yards and hopeless beyond 120 yards. So a lot of the killing is done with a bayonet. And a bayonet is a nasty way to kill. It's a nasty way to die. This is really eyeball to eyeball, nose to nose. It's very intimate. And that kind of intimacy is horrifying.
As the scholar Maya Jasanoff says in our film, we were born in violence. And so I think we've tried to protect, understandably, for the big ideas that are taking place in Philadelphia, first in the Second Continental Congress, which produces the Declaration, and then, of course, with the Constitutional Convention that creates our country. And we think that if we acknowledge the violence, I'm just presupposing this, that somehow it will diminish those big ideas. In fact, I think that those big ideas are actually more inspiring when you understand that they come out of a revolution that is bloody, just guerrilla warfare at times, and unbelievably brutal. A revolution that is also a civil war. So this is a story that we may be more uncomfortable with, but it's got to be understood if you're going to take in this extraordinary story.
The other aspect of this film that I think may surprise some, will certainly be welcomed by others, but may be hard for some to receive, is how, of course, you give voice to enslaved Americans. I think people are familiar with this from your work in the Civil War, but how you give voice especially to Native Americans is a key part of this story of people who are trying to navigate their own survival, but also their own independence in this period.
We hope to be able to survive the winter. And then we mean once more to meet our enemies and see whether we are to live or die. And if such is the will of the Great Spirit, we will leave our bones with those of the rest of our brethren, rather than evacuate our country or give our enemies room to say we fled from them.
These are dozens of individual nations. In fact, the inspiration for the idea of union comes to Benjamin Franklin 20 years before the Revolution, when he hears about the Iroquois Confederacy, five and then later six nations that created what they called was the Haudenosaunee, which was a democracy that had flourished for centuries, but it also banded together for trade and for foreign policy. So we just started off by saying, we want to understand all the players, not just a George Washington or a Thomas Jefferson or a John Adams, but also a Betsy Ambler from Yorktown, as well as Tyendinago and Dragon Canoe. Most people, 99.9%, Michelle, don't have their portrait painted, right? Mm-hmm. That does not mean they don't exist.
It has to be said that we are in a political moment where this administration, at a very high level, has been actively seeking a sort of purging of materials and ideas from public places, particularly that they consider to be not complementary to their vision of the American story. I see that in other interviews, you've kind of dismissed the idea that this is the most divided period ever. Are you comforted by that? I mean, do you think we should be?
I just want to say, when you look at the Revolution, we were really divided then, really divided. People were killing their neighbors. Our Civil War, we murdered, we now think, perhaps 750,000 of our own people. I did a film on Vietnam. There were hundreds of bombings in the late 60s and up to the mid-70s, hundreds of bombings that were taking place. I think we forget that. And almost every period that I've focused on, you find enormous differences between people. I think it's an incredibly patriotic film. I think it reminds us of why this experiment is so special. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that a lot of the people talked about you and me. They talked about the unborn millions. They were speaking to us, and we've got an obligation to listen to what they were offering, to understand what they thought was important. And I'm talking about everybody, all the players, and then try to hand that off to our posterity. And maybe the blips that we are so focused on, the navels that we constantly gaze at, won't seem as important.
Ken Burns is the co-director of the documentary series, The American Revolution. The first episode is coming to PBS on Sunday. You'll want to check your local listings for exact times. Ken Burns, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle.
This is NPR News.
John Lennon and Yoko Ono's message of nonviolence is pretty well known.
I think it's as simple as peace and love, you know.
I'm Elsa Chang. John and Yoko's son, Sean Ono Lennon, talks with me about what's less understood about his famous parents, especially his mom. And we get into the new documentary, One to One, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 6:30. You can hear All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on People Powered KAXE. Welcome back to John Bauer. I'm Heidi
Thank you.
Holton.
Morning.
Good morning. You were out in the
West, out in Wyoming, the wide open spaces. I went out there to paint someone's interior of their house, and it's a beautiful, wealthy community. But it was fun to see that different part of the world, see the mountains, see the open sky. It was pretty. But speaking of open sky, we got to talk about the Northern Lights.
Oh, yeah.
It sure made you feel like the world was a good place for a little while.
Well, you know, the new episode of the Season Watch Pod came out yesterday, and that's a big portion of what we talk about. You're going to have to listen to it. You can hear it on the radio tomorrow at 1:30 and Sunday at 10:30, or get it on your phone, set up for the podcast through Spotify, Apple, all the things. Anyway, one of the things that I was saying was I found myself texting, like, you know, a friend chain, which would be normal to say, are you outside? But people that I don't normally even connect with. I just want to make sure everybody was outside.
Shared the beauty, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I texted a neighbor that I never text unless something major happened.
It's what I'm saying. It made the world a better place. It brought people together.
Yeah. And then Charlie did some research. And because I've always, you know, wondered, of course, as most do, like, why is the photo so different than the naked eye?
Mm-hmm.
And why do we say naked eye? Anyway, that's different. But she did some research into each color means different things and is telling you how far away it is from you. So red is when the coronal mass ejection is hitting the oxygen. Red is oxygen. And then blue means nitrogen or green.
Really? I didn't know any of this stuff.
Yeah, it's in the podcast. You're going to have to listen to it. It's very interesting.
Well, you know, I really very seldom see the Northern Lights because it seems like where I live or wherever I've always lived, there's like trees in the way.
Yeah.
I mean, they're on the horizon. And Laura Connolly called me and said, get outside. And I went outside and it was straight up. That doesn't seem common, was it? That it's straight up?
You know, the stars aligned. I don't know what to say.
And then I thought, this is brilliant. This is brilliant. I'm going to grab my binoculars. You can't see them through the binoculars.
No.
Well, so that's
it has to do with
cool.
how your eye works. We can't see as much light as a camera can.
Hmm.
You know, the camera slows down.
Yeah.
And like I'm probably not saying it right. Charlie explains it better.
That's okay, though. I get it. You're right, because the camera is like amazingly bright versus the human eye.
Well, and I've always thought it was a little bit of a trick, like, when you see people post their photos and they're brilliant, you're kind of like,
touched up a bit.
But did you see them? You know, but it's not. It's just that we as humans can't see it in the same way. And the level of cameras that we have these days. Anyway.
Do you know that there was a meteorite storm too? Did you see any star? I saw a couple of meteorites the first Tuesday night.
Yeah.
Going parallel to the ground.
A lot of folks were seeing that. I didn't understand, like, people who live only maybe 5 miles from me were seeing so different than what I was seeing. Like, ours was just straight up over the barn, and it was more just green and blue streaks, but it was sort of like streaks pointing into, I think, Jupiter or a really bright star. So it was just like, what? Are we supposed to know something? You know, like, it felt like a sign or, you know, but it was so much lighter than other people were seeing. And not, you know, we live on the edge of town, and this is people in town who don't normally see it. And the best Northern Lights I've ever seen prior to this week was in the middle of winter where we walked out on the lake.
Oh, sure.
And that was amazing. Yeah.
Some people just saw the white. You look like witches and whatever.
Yeah. No, so, it is. I mean, honestly, that's the thing behind why we put together this new podcast of Season Watch, is that there's something about nature that can connect us all. You know, and we have it in common. We don't have to know everything about it. That's the whole, you know, mantra behind Phenology and behind Season Watch, is like, all you do is observe and start getting curious and ask some questions. And this week was a perfect example of that. We had so many people texting in photos.
Oh, I bet.
And our Facebook page, we got a whole bunch of photos there. So, you know, and speaking of that, John, coming up later, we're talking about the importance of photography, which I know is near and dear to your heart. Chelsea Perkins is going to be joining us, our news director, at 8:45. This week, the Brainerd Lakes area lost a staple in the community, Steve Coles, photographer at the Brainerd Dispatch, who's just been there since 1975. And Chelsea worked with him for many years, and he was kind of a mentor. So we're going to, she had interviewed him in a podcast. So we're going to hear a little bit of his philosophy behind his photography as a community photographer.
Cool.
And we'll remember Steve Coles today. That's coming up before 9.
And I have one more question. It's a phonology question, and it's absolutely silly, but it's been driving me crazy. I enjoy taking baths, all right?
I'm okay with that.
That's where we're going to stop there.
All right.
But I'm taking a bath, and, you know, we've had the Asian beetles. You know, they've taken over the world. Well, I have two left, and I haven't killed these two. They're in the bathtub area. And I'm saying to myself, now these two have been there for like 5 weeks.
Okay.
My point is, what do they eat to survive? There's nothing. Why don't they perish?
There's probably other little bugs that you don't see, John.
Oh my gosh, they've got to be little.
Well, they're little. I mean.
I know, but I think it's a legitimate question if there's any etymologists? Is that what? Is out there?
I think so.
What the heck do Asian beetles live on?
So you're just
going to,
have you named them? They're just going to live in your bathtub.
No, but whenever I'm taking a bath, they come down and say hi. And then one will get down.
So you are living with them.
So, yeah. And then one will crawl up straight up the wall, like 6 feet, like it's nobody's, like he's Hercules.
Well, and you know not to crush them. You know what happens.
Yeah.
A lot of stink coming off of those Asian beetles. But
I'm proud of them. They've hung in there, and I just want to know if I should feed them. I'm kidding. I'm not going to feed them. I just was curious why they are still alive.
You might want to feed them. I don't know. They sound like they're your friends.
They are.
We'd love to hear from you this morning. Help John out with his questions
Asian beetle
of the world.
Relationship crisis.
Text us 218-326-1234. Coming up from National Native News, a new study aims to shed light on the hidden impacts of domestic violence in Native communities. Mostly sunny for today with highs 54 to 60 and south winds 5 to 10, gusts up to 20. Slight chance of rain overnight with mostly cloudy skies, 30 to 39 and south winds 5 to 10, but becoming northwest, possibly gusts up to 20. Sunny to partly sunny on Saturday, temperatures in the low 40s. A little chillier on Sunday with highs in the mid-30s to low 40s.
So, 10 to 30 mile-per-hour winds on Saturday.
Yeah, watch out.
Watch out.
I don't want you to answer it yet because I know you're going to have a lot to say. But the question of the week I'm going to lay out for you. And then we're going to listen to National Native News. What do you remember about your home ec and your shop classes? Stay tuned for John's answer, no doubt.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new study aims to shed light on the hidden impacts of domestic violence in Native communities. The Mountain West News Bureau's Daniel Spalding reports on the effort to understand the unrecognized brain injuries many survivors are living with.
The Urban Indian Health Institute survey aims to find out how common traumatic brain injuries are among Native survivors of domestic and sexual violence. More than 80% of Indigenous women have experienced violence in their lifetime. According to Abigail Echohawk, the Institute's director, many survivors of domestic and sexual violence suffer from brain injuries that never get diagnosed or receive proper care.
They deserve justice, they deserve safety, and they deserve to get the treatment that they need when they've been impacted by traumatic brain injury.
The goal of the survey is to ensure survivors get the right care and support through programs and policies designed to help them heal. The survey began in October and will remain open through January 2026. I'm Daniel Spalding.
A nonprofit has released a new UPIC glossary with behavioral health terms. UPIC speakers, including those affected by the recent Western Alaska storm, which devastated communities, can use it to communicate with their health providers and to understand their mental health better. Ayulna Naiden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Last month, Moses Mahak Wiseman was helping with UPIC translation at the Anchorage shelters that hosted evacuees from the recent Western Alaska storm. He was also sharing a new glossary with UPIC words for behavioral health terms.
When you have a culture of your own that's not a part of American culture, it's a taboo thing to talk about behavioral health and mental health care. So like having this available when it was available, it's just an ease of mind, I think.
Wiseman is the Alaska Native Languages Program Director at the Alaska Institute for Justice. Last month, the nonprofit released a new glossary. People can type in a modern health-related term.
Self-stigma.
And listen to its Yupik pronunciation.
Shmenik gazmukluni.
Wiseman says it should help Yupik interpreters and service providers to break down language barriers and help people understand their health better. Indra Arriaga is the strategic and operational director at the Institute for Justice.
Where you do have a stigma around depression, a stigma around suicide. This is a way of getting information and not feeling like you're exposing yourself, right? It's out there, it's reliable, it's in your language, it's a door.
Arriaga says the glossary has been years in the making in collaboration with Yupik speakers. The plan was to launch the project on November 1st, but when the remnants of the Typhoon Halong forced hundreds of people to evacuate to Anchorage, the organization decided to release it sooner.
The care and the healing of the folks who are here from Kipnuk and other villages is going to continue. So this is a resource that now can really be used in settings where they're going to be talking about different things that affect their mental health.
The organization is now looking for funding to complete a similar glossary, but for terms relevant for emergency care and intake. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
The National Congress of American Indian says it welcomes the reopening of the federal government to restore stability to critical services to tribes. In a statement, NCAI said during the shutdown, the Indian Health Service largely remained open due to advance appropriations, but it's depending on Congress to extend Affordable Care Act tax credits, and that reopening the government restores funding to food assistance programs that many Native people rely on. The organization says temporary fixes are not enough and that data collected from tribes during the shutdown made clear how long-term lasting solutions and structural funding reforms are needed to honor tribal trust and treaty obligations. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding.
Thanks to the Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, we bring you National Native News. It's made possible in part by the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and listeners or members like you. That's not Emma Thompson, Sean. Figuring some other things out there. It looks like her. You're right, but it's not.
I know who
she is. We're talking about some shows on Apple right now. I've been texting a lot with Julie Crabb about Morning Show is in the midst of their season right now. And it's on Apple, and things are getting crazy.
If you haven't, and if Julie Crabb, I'm sure she has not seen Slow Horses with Gary Oldman, Kristen Scott,
yeah.
Good Lord, is it good. But buckle up.
Yeah, it's not something I can watch. I can't handle the dark stuff. So there you go. Coming up, we will be bringing you the set list, also the talk back segment, and we're going to take a listen to our album of the week. It's Mavis Staples.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah.
What is it, like her 50th?
She's 85. I don't know how many albums she's put out. No, 86, excuse me.
Didn't she just come out with one not that long ago?
Yeah, she does one every year
wow.
and a half. Yeah. And always with new people she's involved with.
Nice. Well, I think IM Hotel in Grand Rapids, providing amenities like their large parking lot suitable for trailers and boats and offering fresh baked breakfast items each day. IM Hotel Timberlake.com.
We gotta have peace. The world alive and the war to cease. We got to have joy, true in our hearts, with strength we can't destroy. People hear us through our voice, the world knows, and there's no choice. We're begging to save the children, the little ones who just don't understand. Give them a chance to live their lives and purify the land. People hear us through through our voice, the world it knows there's no choice. No. And the people in the neighborhood, they would if they only could meet and shake the other's hand, work together for the good of the land, give us all an equal chance. It could be such a sweet romance. And the soldiers who are dead and gone, if we could only bring back one, he'd say, we got to have peace. We got to have peace to keep the world alive and the war to cease. We got to have joy true in our hearts with strength we can't destroy. People hear us through our voice, the world knows there's no choice. And the people in the neighborhood, they would if they only could meet and shake the other's hand, work together for the good of the land, give us all an equal chance. It could be such a sweet romance. And the soldiers who are dead and gone, if we could only bring back one, he'd say, we've got to have peace. We've got to have peace, y'all. Yeah. Got to have peace. Oh, we got to have peace.
Peace. Peace.
Got to have peace.
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 Peace. Oh, peace. We got to have peace.
Was I right?
No kidding.
Making us feel hopeful in a cynical world. That's Mavis Staples. Her album is Sad and Beautiful World, but the song there was We Gotta Have Peace. And on this album, she is featuring artists like Waxahachie, Derek Trox, Bon Iver, MJ wow. Lenderman, Nathaniel Rateliff, Buddy Guy, Jeff Tweedy, Trey Burt, and more people.
I saw Jeff Tweedy on Colbert a couple weeks ago. It's pretty good.
He's great.
What? That's a great photo. Just sitting at the dining room table.
Yeah, with the lace, like lace curtains.
Yeah.
Yellow walls, lace. It's a small kitchen table.
86 and has a voice like that?
I know.
Wow. That is.
It says here, this is how probably Kari describes it. Released at 86 years old, period. Queen, period. We want to know what you think. Check out KAXE.org. Now a new feature from our news team there of fresh picks, not just the album of the week, but some of the newest stuff. It's a way to stay
like it.
Very, like John, when you head to your next cocktail party,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not kidding, you actually go to cocktail parties. I do not, but you will sound really cool. Take a look at that, read a little bit, and then walk in with
be
that
hip.
Tidbit of knowledge.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good.
Just helped your social life right there.
Speaking of social life, another thing, went to the movie a couple nights ago. Went
wow.
to the Springsteen movie.
Oh, okay.
Have you been to it?
I have not.
Now, listen, I really never was a Bruce Springsteen fan. I mean, I really was. I mean, born in the USA, it was kind of funky. It was kind of a modern thing. But it's kind of pop is what I think of it as.
Okay.
Born in the USA. But you know, the last 3 years, I've really been listening to his music and love it. I mean, I love his lyrics and things like that. This movie is very good, but it doesn't focus on his whole career. It focuses on mm-hmm. the Nebraska time and mainly focuses on his mental health.
Mm-hmm.
He was a mess.
I bet you loved it.
I did. It was very, very, very good.
Right.
Very good. It's a good show. Just to see somebody who struggles and he's got all the help he needed and he fought his way through it. And seems like just a blue-collar guy, and that's the reputation I guess he has. I want to thank Itasca County Habitat for Humanity presenting their annual fundraiser, Building for Tomorrow, on Tuesday, November 18th from 4:30 to 6:30 at the Cohasset Community Center. Events include mission moments, silent auction items, and more. Itascahabitat.org.
This is The Set List on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are taking a look at four shows this week, Friday and Saturday, November 14th and 15th, in Aiken, Baxter, Gilbert, and Grand Rapids. Starting things off, acclaimed folk musician, theater composer, and disability rights activist Galen Lee is playing at the Underground in Aiken this Friday, a new venue in the basement of the Ripple Center. The singer and violinist has collaborated with artists like Michael Stipe and Alan Sparhawk, won the 2016 NPR Tiny Desk competition, and recently scored the latest run of Macbeth on Broadway. Galen Lee at the Underground this Friday at 6 p.m. in Aiken. In Baxter, Americana and roots rocker Christopher David Hansen is playing Jack Pine Brewery Friday at 6 p.m. A prolific musician, Hansen plays in multiple Northern Minnesota bands and mixes blues, rock, and singer-songwriter folk in his solo music. The third Friday show is Jay Streitz at the Ore House in Gilbert, 7 p.m. Streitz is an alt-country songwriter who spent years as a bass player in Twin Cities country bands. He now lives in the Northwoods and leads the group Jay Streitz and the Long Odds. It's this Friday, 7 p.m. at the Ore House in Gilbert. And finally, one Saturday show for you is the duo Between Howls at Rapids Brewing at 6 p.m. Ren and Nick Howell are both top-notch musicians whose live show ranges from breakneck shredding to soulful ballads and everything in between. They released their debut album Cabin Fever earlier this year. Between Howls this Saturday at Rapids Brewing, 6 p.m. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
.651, thanks for tuning in. It's Friday morning. Hope you're having a good day. About an hour from now, we'll be in the midst, hopefully, fingers crossed, of Talkin' Breakfast. And if you are someone who wants to join us, maybe you had good luck at the deer stand last weekend. So this weekend, you're going to be the cook. Who knows? Maybe you're not a deer hunter. You can join us and you can make a reservation and join us now by texting 218-326-1234.
So speaking of cooking, I'm sorry to keep going back to this thing, but when I was in Sheridan, Wyoming, I go to a place called the Rusty Spoon, Heidi. It's a local mom and pop. And it is just packed in there. And there's a woman who owns the restaurant, and she will not let anybody else cook. I mean, it's the hottest place in town. It's jam-packed. You stand outside. Watching the salt of the earth person making food for probably 80 people for 6 hours mm-hmm. is amazing. I mean, it's incredible. Hot, you know. 8 slabs of bacon.
What'd you order?
In the left hand, cracking 3 eggs, yeah. The other, then putting it down, flipping the 500 pounds of hash browns, then throwing the bread in the bucket for the French toast, reaching it with her hand, not with a glove on, reaching with the hand, spigging it, throwing it on the giant griddle. I just think that's Americana. That's beautiful stuff.
What'd you order?
I digress. I got a gargantuan omelet. I didn't know. I mean, I've never had an omelet there. It was the size of a football and then hash browns. That was
crispy?
Good. Yeah, and it lasted for about 3 days in my belly. Yeah. It was a good diet plan.
Mostly sunny for today. Highs 54 to 60. South winds 5 to 10. Gusting up to 20 miles an hour. And looking at the current temperatures around the region, beautiful moon this morning and stars. 33 degrees in Brainerd, 31 in Hibbing, 34 in Bemidji, 32 in Grand Rapids. You get the gist. But we're moving on up and going to have a mild day today.
It's going to be amazing
But the winds will feel a little chillier, yeah, I think.
Nothing like the wind blowing through your hair, Heidi. It's time for the Talkback segment of the morning show. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at comments@kaxe.org or you can text us 218-326-1234. That's the same text number you can use to tell me what do Asian beetles eat to survive.
We heard from Noah in Brit last Friday night. He said DJ Ben Franklinstein is absolutely rocking the house tonight. You know it's good when you find yourself Shazamming every song to add to your own playlist. This is what community radio is all about. I love On the River and you know, a little tip here, you can find playlists from shows on our website too at kexe.org. Look under music and look for playlists.
And Heather from Bemidji texted Saturday night saying, Darren White hosted On the River saying, nice show tonight. I'm grooving along while cooking dinner. Seems like that's a common theme in the kitchen, dancing, making food.
Susan from Grand Rapids texted on Wednesday afternoon, please tell Dave Peterson that he has a great mix of music today, especially love hearing Tony Joe White.
And Dave from 50 Lakes commented on the album of the week, Sad and Beautiful World by Mavis Staples. He said, love this album. I saw Mavis with North Mississippi All-Stars about 10 years ago at Luther College.
For our question of the week, we've been asking about your shop and home ec projects. Lisa from Balsam said, in home ec, I made a peasant-style blouse in Madras plaid. The pattern mostly matched, and it was pretty cute. I sold it on the bus on the way home from school.
Wow.
A bonus. Oh, wonder what beautiful. She made. She didn't notice that.
Oh.
What do you remember about your shop class, John? Or home ec? Did you have to do both?
Well, I did home ec. And I've talked about home ec. It was boys cooking, and it was all boys in there. And even though we were screwing around, I did learn a lot about etiquette, about making certain meals and things like that. But shop class has a whole different twist. I think about shop class a lot. That's one of the classes I think about the most. We would go into this giant room, and our teacher was Cliff Culpey. You know, he was the old hockey coach, like the original hockey coach. He couldn't hear very well. And
was he missing a finger? That seems to be a
I think he was missing theme. A few things more than a finger.
All right.
But it was just this big expanse of the room and all different walks of men, boys in there, you know, tough guys and making keychain holders, you know, that look like an old key that you know, a church key, not a church key, you know, the old spider
metal?
Lock. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then gun racks. But I just remember, you know, loving like the grain of wood and asking questions. Do you always sand with the grain or against? Oh, no, you sand with the grain. And I learned about how to put shellac on. And I never could understand if you put a coat of shellac on beautiful wood, it was still so smooth, but they wanted you to sand the smoothness so that you could put another layer on and make it even softer. I still don't understand that today.
Maybe to hold up longer?
No, it's not necessarily that. You want to get a smooth substance. You know, so if you put polyurethane on a piece of wood, you let it dry, and then they want you to sand it lightly with something real, like 320 grit. And I never understood that. Why am I going to scratch up something so beautiful? Is it really going to be better? So you sand it, you wipe it down, you put another coat on, maybe three coats, and it was beautiful. But the one thing I remember was my fear of lathe, working on the lathe, the noise it would make, and the occasional release rocket of a piece of wood that would fly across the room.
Well,
it was scary.
In our shop class, Mr. Janssen would scared the bejesus out of us, and I've already mentioned this probably three times this week, but if you had long hair.
Oh, gosh, stay away from the lathe.
Yeah, I mean, it was really scary. The one thing I wanted to ask you about, maybe not one, there's a couple here, but this whole question came about because of last week's What's for Breakfast. When you weren't here, we had Kevin call in, and Kevin had lived in the Twin Cities but moved up in high school to the Grand Rapids area and was so shocked at, like, boys would bring guns to school during hunting season, and that in home ec class you made a gun case.
Oh yeah,
do you remember that?
Oh gosh, yeah.
Okay,
proud of that gun case.
And then we also heard from someone else from Grand Rapids who was saying that he chose, you know, Billy the pie man. He chose to not make the gun case, but he made the quillo or something. It was a pillow that was also a quilt that folded up. Do you remember this?
No, I do not. This is 80s, obviously, or something.
And in the Brainerd area, we also had, you know, our shop class included leather and mechanical drawing was the first segment.
Yep.
And then it was wood shop, and then it was metal class. But so you had leather too?
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah.
I like
made keychains and stuff. That was you'd stamp them.
That's when I made Bert the B-minus belt.
Oh, and mechanical drawing. I loved it. I loved doing the pen, the numbers, like the nine had a tail. It swooped.
I liked it too.
But did you have boys in your shop class?
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember having girls in my shop class. Must have. I just don't remember it.
Yeah. No, it was boys and girls.
And another thing that just came to mind is I found this just the other day. My girlfriend at the time, Susan Johnson, made the glass thing and then you embossed a picture in it. Mm. So it's like the if you cut off the bottom of a Coke glass, it was a round thing. Then there's a picture of me. Then there's kind of mud put underneath